This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this edition of the program, part one of America's opioid crisis. Hello again, I'm Carol Castiel. America's pain problem, that's what many experts are saying led to the opioid epidemic that is sweeping the nation. What started with people using prescription drugs to alleviate pain following an operation became an addiction for many Americans. It is a complex crisis with roots in years of overprescription and abuse of opioid pills. In 2015, more than 52,000 people died of drug overdoses, nearly two-thirds of which were linked to opioids. Drug overdoses in 2015 killed more people than car crashes and gun homicides combined. Unlike the crack cocaine epidemic of the 1980s, opioid drug users are not centered in the big cities or among blacks and Hispanics. Rather, they are centered in rural areas and suburbs among whites. According to the Wall Street Journal, opioid abuse today ranks among the nation's biggest public health challenges, with drug overdoses now the leading cause of death among Americans under the age of 50. In mid-August, U.S. President Donald Trump declared the country's opioid crisis a national emergency. Declaring an emergency could allow states and cities that are hard hit by the opioid crisis to receive federal disaster relief funds and other types of urgent aid. Well, for more about the causes and magnitude of the opioid crisis in America, I am joined by senior VOA correspondent Chris Simpkins, VOA's lead reporter on this issue, as well as Dr. Caleb Alexander, co-director of the Johns Hopkins Center for Drug Safety and Effectiveness, and Dr. Wilson Compton, deputy director of the National Institute on Drug Abuse at the National Institutes of Health. And all panelists join me here at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington. Welcome to the program.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you for having us.
Well, Dr. Compton, how would you characterize the opioid epidemic in America, and what do you think are the primary factors driving it?
Well, certainly we see the opioid crisis as a major epidemic of overdose deaths. That's been what's been driving the attention, is just the astounding number of people that are killed by taking too much and too many of these medications or street drugs. It's been driven originally by excess availability of prescription medications. There was an urge to treat pain more effectively in the 1980s and 90s, and there was kind of a myth that if a medication was prescribed for pain, it wouldn't be habit-forming, it wouldn't be addictive. Turns out that that was a major mistake.
Let me turn to Dr. Caleb Alexander for your take on the primary factors driving this crisis in America.
I agree with Dr. Compton, and you know, it's a very complex epidemic. It's been getting worse, in some ways hidden in plain sight, for more than 20 years now. When I was a resident training in clinical practice to become a physician, we were routinely taught that if a patient had quote-unquote true or quote-unquote legitimate pain, that one need not worry about the addictive potential of these drugs. And that's simply false. And I was part of a whole generation of physicians and healthcare professionals that were trained as such. There have also been a number of products that have been brought to market and aggressively marketed and promoted. And one has got to face it that this is a big business. $10 to $12 billion a year in estimated opioid sales, and in many cases, very aggressive marketing and promotion on the part of pharmaceutical companies. We also have huge numbers of people that have untreated chronic pain. In many cases, this pain is not cancer-related or related to pain at the end of life, but rather is chronic pain from things like backaches or headaches or osteoarthritis. And there are millions of Americans that have such pain. And unfortunately, all too often, we've been too quick to reach for opioids, mistakenly thinking that these are the most safe and effective medicines, when nothing could be further from the truth.
Gentlemen, terrific insights from you both. And now I'd like to turn to my colleague, Chris Simpkins, who has been traveling around the country taking the pulse of what is going on. So, Chris, from your travels around the country, what have you learned? Who is affected and why and where?
Thanks, Carol, for having me on the show today. I would say and agree with the guest, this is a very complicated issue. And I see when I travel around the country, virtually no community has not been touched by this opioid abuse crisis. But the thing that I'm seeing the most affected are individuals between the ages of 24, 31. We see one age group there, and we see an older age group between the ages of 35 and 41 years old who have become addicted, who were prescribed the medication for a backache or some type of other illness, who liked the way the pills made them feel, and they couldn't stop using it. And then when they couldn't get the pills, they went to illegal street drugs like heroin. And the addiction from that is even another challenge. So it's a scene where I'm seeing a large number of Caucasians, white males, more white males than white females. But that seems to be the population that has been affected now by it. I don't see it as much in the black community. But that's what we found as we've traveled around the country. And these pockets of people who are unemployed, have extreme poverty, also suffer from behavioral issues. And this is what I've been seeing as I've gone around the country.
I'd like to turn back now to Dr. Wilson Compton, Deputy Director of the National Institute on Drug Abuse. Dr. Compton, with regard to the American culture of taking a pill for what ails one, I wanted you to address that, because something that Dr. Alexander mentioned really struck me about how some people now are taking these very potent opioids for perhaps less than what they were originally supposed to take care of. I know I myself had a broken arm a couple of years ago. I had serious surgery, and I was prescribed OxyContin, oxycodone, etc. And it was very hard to get, which is very odd, because this is when you really need those types of painkillers. What is going on? How did we get to the point where opioids are now being taken for backaches or other things that would not normally require this serious type of medication?
I think there are two factors at play here. One, what you're describing is some problems with our education around how to treat pain effectively. So while patients may be suffering extraordinarily from discomforts and aches and pains, and that's a major reason why you go to a physician, why you go to a health center, but reaching simply for a prescription of opioids to treat that pain is a mistake. And unfortunately, that's been the lesson that all too many physicians got during their training, that you have a pain, we'll give you a pain reliever. Unfortunately, there are other approaches that should be considered that often aren't considered. I'd also like to point out that it's not just our patients that are at risk. This is an unusual situation where it's not just about the person in front of us, but it's also about all the people around that individual. What I mean by that is the pills go into a home and then they may be diverted and shared with other people. So it's not just the patient to whom the prescriptions are written, but also those that come into their house, whether that's other family members or friends, the babysitter's boyfriend or girlfriend, that may take them out of the medicine cabinet and put themselves at risk because those prescriptions weren't written for them.
That's a terribly important issue. And the amount of diversion from patients receiving prescriptions to friends and family members is staggering and I think often underestimated. We recently completed a study looking at the post-surgical setting, and patients on average up to 70% or 7 out of 10 patients after surgery report having opioids remaining at the end of their treatment course. So there are vast supplies of opioids in people's kitchen cabinets and bedroom nightstands and bathroom shelves. And all too often, these end up diverted, in some cases intentionally, in other cases unintentionally, and contributing to the epidemic. There's another really important point to emphasize here, which is that if you look at the trajectory of opioid sales and then compare that to the trajectory of injuries and deaths from these products, they are virtually parallel. They are virtually identical. That is, that the volume of opioids is so closely related to the volume of injuries and deaths from these products. And this has really important implications for our use of opioids in clinical practice, because it suggests that until we get to a point where we do start using some of the safer and more effective alternatives to opioids, we shouldn't expect significant reductions in opioid-related injuries and deaths.
A quick follow-up to you, Dr. Caleb Alexander. director of the Johns Hopkins Center for Drug Safety and Effectiveness. What are the alternatives that you would recommend to these opioids?
Well, clinicians have dozens of tools in the toolbox, and all too often we've been far too quick to reach for opioids. And another thing worth noting is that not only do opioids have a very important and very serious dose-dependent toxicity, that is, the higher the dose, the greater the safety risks, but they're also not terribly effective for treating chronic non-cancer pain. So the irony is that we've both overestimated the effectiveness of these products as well as underestimated their risks. There are dozens of alternatives to treat patients that have pain. Some of these are other prescription drugs. For example, over-the-counter treatments, including non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, things like ibuprofen, are often quite effective for people that have many types of pain. But there are other prescription drugs. For example, there are several classes of prescription drugs that are used for patients that have what we call neuropathic pain, or pain that originates from nerve problems, things like gabapentin or pregabalin or duloxetine. And then there are a whole host of non-pharmacologic treatments, things like physical therapy, occupational therapy, acupuncture, massage, biofeedback, and the list goes on. But all too often, our system has been designed and structured so as to promote opioids at the expense of these alternatives.
I guess that leads me to ask you, Dr. Wilson Compton, to weigh in on that and to what extent maybe the drug companies have something to do with this profit rather than prescribing the less invasive types of pain medication and much less expensive. Is that a factor?
Well, certainly economics have been driving this crisis in multiple ways, whether that's the economics of pharmaceutical sales, the economics of the heroin market, or even in the current epidemic of fentanyl overdoses, the tremendous profits that are available in selling fentanyl on the street. But I'd like to point out that the need for better medications to treat pain is a major priority at the National Institutes of Health. And this is a place where actually we think we can partner with the pharmaceutical industry to really make great strides. By working together, we can bring new products that may not be addictive or habit-forming to the market to allow people to have their pain treated safely without producing the respiratory depression and death.
You're listening to Encounter on the Voice of America. I'm Carol Castiel, along with Chris Simpkins, senior VOA correspondent. Our guests are Dr. Caleb Alexander, co-director of the Johns Hopkins Center for Drug Safety and Effectiveness, and Dr. Wilson Compton, from whom you just heard. He's deputy director of the National Institute on Drug Abuse at the National Institutes of Health. We are discussing the opioid epidemic in America. And this is a reminder that our Encounter podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/encounter. You may also follow me on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA or connect with us on Facebook. Now here's a shout out to Amir Jamil from Pakistan. Thanks so much for listening. If you want to hear your name on the air, please send an email to encounter@voanews.com or like us on Facebook. And now I'd like to turn to my colleague Chris Simpkins for either a comment or a question.
Well, I wanted to go back to some of the early beginnings of where this started, and we had talked about diversion. I started down in South Florida, Miami, Fort Lauderdale area, West Palm Beach. And what I found out in those communities back in the late 1990s, early 2000s, there was this proliferation of these pain clinics. They were all over the place. And people would go to these pain clinics to say they had a backache or knee ache or shoulder ache, and doctors would readily prescribe them with these opioids. And then what happened is it wasn't just people from South Florida. Law enforcement officials started seeing cars with license plates from Ohio, Indiana, West Virginia, Kentucky, all coming down to South Florida to easily be prescribed these legal opioids. They were driving back to their communities and then, as our guest said, began to share these opioids with family and friends. And so law enforcement in South Florida began to see a problem with this opioid crisis probably back in 2002. And so when we talk about where this started, a lot of people point to rural areas. And some of the people that I talk to say those people came to South Florida, got their opioids, drove back to these rural states and states now where we see the biggest problems with opioid abuse and overdose deaths in places like Ohio and West Virginia. So it's interesting. That's one aspect of how some of this got started.
It's interesting that you describe that as pain clinics, and I would call those rogue medical practices doing essentially malpractice or semi-legal drug dealing. We were very pleased to see when Florida implemented new policies to limit those kind of facilities that they saw a marked reduction in prescription sales, but more importantly, saw a wonderful reduction in the overdose deaths in Florida. So by changing the availability of these excess prescriptions, which were going into the street in so many ways, we saved a lot of lives.
The clinics are really noteworthy for just how much they stand out from standard clinical practice, and I think law enforcement should be congratulated and supported for shutting these down. I do always, when we talk about the rogue prescribers or patients sometimes that are referred to as quote-unquote opioid shoppers, patients that is that shop around from doctor to doctor to get more tablets, I always have a little bit of concern because my concern is that we focus on those patients at the expense of recognizing the much, much broader and more pervasive problem that we have within our healthcare system in the United States. So I think that there's a really important opportunity both to recognize that there are a small subset of doctors that by all means require identification and de-licensure, that is, their licenses should be removed because they're practicing rogue medicine, as it were. But we also have to keep in mind that the vast majority of opioids that end up in circulation are prescribed by regular physicians practicing primary care and in some cases pain medicine that are treating patients just like you and me.
But are they also beginning to decrease? Is there a movement in the United States given this crisis? Are they starting to decrease the prescription and make sure that these opioids are only prescribed for, you know, after surgery or very serious conditions? And then, you know, with more the types of measures that you earlier talked about, ibuprofen and less addictive types of drugs.
And we've seen modest reductions in opioid sales in the United States in the past 2 to 3 years. But keep in mind the staggering volume of opioids that is prescribed in the United States. The U.S. accounts for about 5% of the world's population and 80% of prescription opioids consumed around the world. So enough opioids are prescribed in the United States to supply every adult in the country a one-month continuous supply of medicines. Fortunately, we have seen opioid sales plateau and then decline modestly, perhaps 10% decline or so over the past few years, but we have a long, long way to go. And we are still prescribing vastly higher levels of opioids than we were 10 or 20 years ago and than any other country in the world is prescribing.
That's a very interesting way to put it and put it in an international context,
it
Chris.
Is. It really is. And I've spoken to some physicians. The other thing that's going on here from what they've told me, there's a lot of pressure on physicians to have high patient satisfaction scores. So if they want those scores to be high, they want to keep those patients happy. Can you talk about that a little bit and the pressure of physicians to prescribe these drugs because they are trying to keep their HCAP or their patient satisfaction scores high?
Well, this is another element of the epidemic, and it's certainly another factor that's often cited as having contributed to the epidemic. About 10 or 15 years ago, there was an initiative called Pain is the Fifth Vital Sign that encouraged clinicians, in addition to blood pressure and pulse and temperature and respiratory rate, to measure and track pain. And indeed, many health systems and hospitals and clinics began routinely monitoring the levels of pain in patients. And so you're absolutely right that this emphasis, very well-intentioned and laudable emphasis to try to identify and measure and track and address pain better at a population level, in some ways backfired. Here we are with more people dying from these medicines than ever before. But it is the case that many patients have poorly treated pain, and it's important to emphasize that there's no conflict between improving the quality of care for those in pain on the one hand and reducing our over-reliance on opioids on the other.
It seems to me it's a question of education as much as anything. Dr. Compton, I'd like to get your take on this vicious cycle that we've been documenting. Dr. Caleb Alexander said, and I believe you also agree, that opioids have not been found to be effective for chronic pain, and yet they are still being prescribed for that, and people becoming addicted to them think that they are, maybe it's just in their head that these opioids actually help them, but even if they don't, they're already addicted. How do we stop this vicious cycle?
I think the best approach would be not to start down that pathway to begin with. So what we see in the recent advice from the Centers for Disease Control in guidelines that were released last year to help support the better treatment of those with chronic non-cancer pain is try to avoid opioids to begin with. Use other treatments, and if opioids are required, to start at very low doses and keep them low. One of the key issues, though, that we're beginning to see is that in this concern about opioids, we are seeing patients where their medications may be stopped suddenly. And that's not safe either. So once we have patients who are stably on these medications, even for a long time, we have to be careful not to cut them off too suddenly and leave them without any of the supports they need. So this is part of the complexity of this situation, is both the overtreatment and then even at times the undertreatment of pain in our country and all across the globe.
I've experienced that pain. I was diagnosed with a herniated disc, extreme pain down the left side of my leg, and I was prescribed OxyContin. It took care of the pain, but I found that I could not work while under the influence of this opioid. So I was desperately trying to seek some alternatives. I went to a pain doctor who specializes in non-opioid treatments. He gave me an epidural steroid injection in my back, which cleared the pain up for 6 months, and I didn't have to take opioids. So I think there's a lot of alternatives, as we've mentioned before, to relieve that pain, and which allowed me to return to work. And we're so worried about the loss of productivity now in this country because of opioids. So personally, I'm a very strong believer of other alternatives because I've seen personally it's worked for me.
And we'll talk more about those in part two of our program. But let me turn back now to Caleb Alexander. We're having a crackdown now. We see the ravages of the opioid crisis. As both of you said, perhaps we're trying to not prescribe as many of these serious and potent drugs for pain. So there's been a crackdown. We have more regulation. But then it seems that these legally produced and distributed prescription drugs have given way to illegal sales and the use of fentanyl, which is a drug even more potent than heroin. What do you say about this particular trend?
It's a very serious issue, and Wilson Compton, who joins me today, and co-authors published a paper in the New England Journal of Medicine that I think is one of the best I've read, examining the interrelationship of prescription opioids on the one hand and heroin and fentanyl on the other. And there's a lot that could be said about these products and these relationships. One point I'd make is that we really have two epidemics in one. And in some ways, these are two sides of the same coin. After all, if you look at the chemical structure of OxyContin and compare it with that of heroin, it's virtually indistinguishable. And so in some ways, these are two sides of the same coin. In many other ways, they are different epidemics. They have different trajectories. They affect overlapping but distinct populations. The vast majority of people that are addicted to prescription opioids do not, I'll emphasize, do not go on to use heroin or fentanyl. However, most heroin and fentanyl users these days did begin with prescription opioids. I think the most important myth that I'd like to take on is that essentially we have a zero-sum game, so that any effort to reduce prescription opioid volume is going to only come back and bite us by increasing the amount of heroin and fentanyl that's being used. And there's simply not a zero-sum game here where reductions in prescription opioid sales and deaths are countered by equal and opposite increases in heroin and fentanyl. So I think it's important to keep in mind that there are some commonalities with these epidemics, but some important differences as well.
I'm afraid that's all the time we have on this edition of Encounter. I'd like to thank my guests, Chris Simpkins, senior VOA correspondent, Dr. Caleb Alexander, co-director of the Johns Hopkins Center for Drug Safety and Effectiveness, and Dr. Wilson Compton, deputy director of the National Institute on Drug Abuse of the National Institutes of Health. Thank you all for your terrific insights. Please tune in next week for part two of our discussion on America's opioid crisis. Encounter was produced in Washington. Thanks to Rebecca Ward for booking our guests. Our engineer was Pete Hundley. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Encounter on The Voice of America.